The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin. Winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
And now we take you inside the preparations for a presidential State of the Union address.
This is an opportunity for a pep rally. This is an opportunity to trumpet government. Why do we want to pretend to be sorry for intruding?
Because that's what people want to hear.
So I've been told.
Toby.
Why don't you pick your section of the speech, fight with me about it, I'll lose, and then I can call in the next group.
Yeah, you understand.
Pick a section.
At its peak, Aaron Sorkin's television drama, The West Wing, was a top 10 show with 17.1 million viewers. It made the political careers of Martin Sheen as President Bartlet, Allison Janney as Chief of Staff and Press Secretary C.J. Craig, Rob Lowe as Deputy Communications Director, and Richard Schiff as White House Communications Director Toby Ziegler. Richard Schiff is on the line. Welcome to The Takeaway, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. How are you?
Great. Your life after politics is going very well. I gather you're down in Cuba, right?
I am down in Cuba shooting a television show and totally fascinated by this country and this place. Yeah.
Well, we won't talk about Cuba, although there was talk about Cuba in the State of the Union address last night. I'm wondering if you could comment just generally on this notion of art imitating life and life imitating art on a political show like The West Wing. And now we've got House of Cards that really take from reality, but also reality takes from the TV shows at the same time.
Yeah, that's inevitable. As we were so close to the real deal, I think, on The West Wing, because we had consultants who had lived it and had worked it, you know, so from Dee Dee Myers to Lawrence O'Donnell to Eli Addy, who was in the White House, and Dee Dee Myers was the press secretary. I think Aaron and the writing staff had direct access to real stories.
So is it inevitable then that you and your colleagues would take credit for Barack Obama calling for a cure for cancer in the speech last night?
Yeah, no, I saw that reference to the West Wing with all the tweets last night that reminded me of our episode about the same thing. I think that we have to remember that even Santos is run for the office to succeed Bartlet. You know, Santos was based on Obama. Eli Addy, one of our writers, and we all had been in Boston listening to a speech in 2004, and coming up to the next president's election in the West Wing, and Eli Addy called David Axelrod and said, you know, tell me about this kid from Chicago. And it turned into our version of that, turned into Santos. And, of course, the Alan Alda Republican opposition was pretty much based on McCain. If you go back and look at those debates that we did live on the West Wing, they're very similar to the debates that later happened between Obama and McCain.
Let's talk about this idea of what could happen, because it always seemed in the years of the West Wing that President Bartlet could do what real presidents couldn't, that he could think bigger, that he could take bigger risks, that there were there was a sense of mission that was hard to see sometimes in real Washington. I'm wondering if that sense of mission then is a kind of a permission that gets granted to the real White House. They see what happens on a show like The West Wing, and they go, you know, we can go farther with this.
What I find interesting is when people remember the Bartlet administration as one of great accomplishment, I, as Toby, playing Toby, didn't feel that as all. Maybe I was getting too close to my character, but I remember once pitching Aaron Sorkin that Toby was very unsatisfied with what our legacy was going to be. And I pitched a speech between him, between Toby and Leo in the portico, which basically was, where is our great society? Where is our New Deal? We haven't accomplished anything except putting a Hispanic in the Supreme Court. And when you look at what Aaron and the rest of the writing staff and all of us were able to achieve, it was really depicting the difficulty of getting anything done, despite monumental efforts. When you look at what the Obama administration has actually accomplished, as delineated by him last night, it's much greater than anything the Bartlett had accomplished. I think it's quite remarkable. And this speech last night, which I thought was brilliant, reminded me very much of an Aaron Sorkin-esque type of speech. What I loved most about it is how it I felt reprimanded for not participating in our democratic process every day, because I get so bored with the vitriol and the Trumpisms that I just get debilitated by it. And Obama's reprimand to the American citizen, the everyday citizen, to keep participating and not let that vitriol be defeating to us. I thought that was remarkable. You know, he quoted Pope Francis when he said, "To imitate the hatred and violence of tyrants and madness is the best way to take their place." That's extraordinary to me. You know, that he's criticizing the Trumps and the Rubios for waving the flag and drumming up the kind of diatribes that we heard in the 1930s, to me was just very special.
Finally, comment, if you would, on the heroic qualities of the West Wing as contrasted with the, you know, backstabbing, real just nastiness of House of Cards, which is the political show of this era.
Well, House of Cards to me is Macbeth placed in Washington, D.C. You know, so it's a bit of a heightened reality, you know. So I don't think it depicts a reality that exists. Hopefully we're not, you know, murdering each other, and hopefully everyone doesn't have blood on their hands. But I think it does reflect what many of us feel politics have become in Washington, which is that backstabbing, you know, willing to go at any lengths to defeat our opponent, vitriolic separation of interests and parties. So I think it reflects that very accurately, and it's very interesting that that is the show of this era, whereas The West Wing was more a show of, I'm guessing, a more hopeful era.
Richard Schiff, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Have a great day, you guys.
Richard Schiff is the actor who played Toby Siegler, the White House communications director on The West Wing. He's also a political activist. He spoke with us from Havana. 10 years ago, writer and talk show host Tavis Smiley first moderated the annual State of the Black Union, a day-long forum where educators, politicians, and religious leaders outlined what African Americans could do to advance their communities by setting in motion a national plan of action to address the most pressing issues. Here's Louis Farrakhan, leader of the Nation of Islam, speaking at the State of the Black Union back in 2005.
There has to be a covenant made between those of us who have been blessed with knowledge, blessed with wealth, blessed with opportunity to unite the best of our minds that will lift us and our people out of the condition that they're in.
The outcome of those conversations was a number one best-selling book published in 2006, The Covenant with Black America, a series of essays from notable contributors addressing 10 issues from crime reduction and financial well-being to health and education. So 10 years later, 8 years with an African-American president, how is the covenant doing? And how much of it did President Obama address last night? Tavis Smiley, host of The Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International, the PBS television program Tavis Smiley, has edited and compiled The Covenant with Black America 10 years later. Tavis says there's been movement, but if anything, the urgency is even greater today.
The triple threat is still facing our democracy: racism, poverty, and militarism. I'm so tired of Republican and Democrat using that line every year: the state of our union is strong. It's really not.
But your book, The Covenant with Black America, you had 10 covenants. Let me go down the 10 and give you my personal grade on not so much whether we achieved it or not, but whether you were right in nailing something that became an issue later on. Okay?
This I want to hear.
All right.
Okay.
Let's start with number one: securing the right to health care and well-being. Because of Obamacare, I give you a B on that, that new access to health care was given, but Obamacare is still a work in progress.
It is a work in progress. Many of those provisions have not kicked in as yet, as you know, so that black health has not been appreciably impacted at this point in the years to come, I think it will be. At the moment, though, the impact hasn't really been felt, number one. And number two, the Obamacare legislation does nothing, says nothing about disparities in health. And those disparities are still so prevalent.
Let's move to number two, the system of public education in which children can succeed at high levels. A worthy goal, a lot of talk. I don't think a lot of achievement. I say a C, and it's not a grade for you, but it's a C in the sense that this wasn't really achieved.
Some progress has been made for those kids who are black who happen to have access to a charter school.
Charter school, right.
If they have access. But by and large, this debate about school choice still has not turned the corner yet to how we make all schools choice.
It's a zero-sum situation.
Exactly.
Where good over here subtracts from over here.
And what I argue in the text is that we have to find a way, John, to get to a place in this country where every child in America is guaranteed access to an equal high-quality education. We're not talking about judging outcomes, but the starting line ought to be the same. Mm. 50 states, 50 different ways of doing it. So that your educational opportunity really depends on where you're born. It's the luck of the draw. Or if you're in a city where they have good schools like New York City, you got to hope and pray that the ball bounces your way.
Number three, correcting the system of unequal justice, sentencing reform. I give you an A. You were dead on. You nailed it. It's definitely been an issue. There's definitely changes taking place. A lot more to be done. But this is absolutely part of the discussion in America today.
It's a mixed bag for me when I think about Eric Holder, the former attorney general. I love Eric Holder. And yet he and the Obama administration failed over 8 years bringing anybody who wrecked this country to justice. Wall Street steal. Nobody paid for that.
Yeah, I asked him about that last week.
You did? And what did he say? I'm curious.
He said, no, you know, we couldn't bring those prosecutions. We would have all made our careers if we could have, but we couldn't bring them.
I don't buy that. I just don't buy that. But so I feel let down by the fact that they didn't pursue that. But I'm heartened by the fact that on these sentencing issues, Holder gets a lot of credit. And the kinds of drug offenses they're going to prosecute into the future or not prosecute. So I think he gets great marks on that.
A for number four, fostering accountable community-centered policing. Now, people had to die to get this into the discussion, but this is absolutely what's going on right now, and you nailed it years ago.
How are the historians, John, I'm curious as to your take on this. How do you think the historians are going to juxtapose that in the era of the first black president, black boys and black men were being shot and killed in the streets? How do they explain that in the era of the first black president, the bottom just fell out, that we couldn't make the distinction between community policing and policing the community?
Here's, I think, how historians will say.
Okay.
That the Obama presidency was the moment the myth of America died. And the legacy of lynching, the legacy of violence against black men and black bodies, as Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about, is alive and well in the police, in the interactions between white America and black America, and there is an accounting that still has to happen.
I have a different read of that, fundamentally different read of how I think the historians are going to regard the Obama era. That's not my read of it, but we'll come back to that a little bit later maybe.
All right. Yeah. Number five, ensuring broad access to affordable neighborhoods that connect to opportunity. B+, because Obama really took this on.
Well, I'm glad the issue was in the book. I'm glad it was a covenant. And again, with this issue and your analysis just now about the president, on a number of things, we could say this, that he waited too late to jump on some of these things. I don't think the president ever believed that he had as much power as he really had.
All right, 6, 7, and 8, I say D, D, C. Claiming our democracy, D. Strengthening our rural roots, D. Nothing's happened there. Accessing good jobs, wealth, and economic prosperity. The economy has done better. I give it a C, but I don't think African Americans and people in poverty have benefited much.
Yeah, I mean, that's just mind-boggling to me. You got an uptick in a particular jobs report. Everybody else went up. And black folks still went down. Underemployment, unemployment, no longer looking for employment. It's just a bleak picture.
Number nine, assuring environmental justice for all. I give this a B because it's really a part of the conversation. Now, I don't think it's a part of the reality, but this is in a very different place in terms of what people are talking about in the neighborhoods as well as in the sort of Brookings Institution think tanks.
It's a conversation now, and you hate to see it happen because of this, but when you have the water issue in Flint, or you have Porter Ranch in California, I mean, these things keep popping up all the time. The problem is, on the flip side, that the environmental racism hasn't been addressed at all.
Number 10, closing the racial digital divide. You probably know more about this than I do. On the one hand, LeBron has the most popular app, I think, in history. There's Wi-Fi all over in a lot of American cities, but I don't know.
The divide exists, but it was race and class-based. Now it's just class-based. It was race-based until phones, smartphones became affordable enough that every black person has a phone. Everybody got a phone.
Right.
But most black folks still cannot afford a computer and a printer in their home, and there ain't but so much you can do of your homework on a smartphone even. So the divide still exists, but it's more class-based now than race-based.
So what are you running for, Tavis?
Nothing. I relish the role that I have to be a part of the conversation. I love being a generous listener. I'm a curious person. And at the end of the day, the kind of truths that we're telling in this book are the kind of truths I attempt to tell in my work. You can't do that and run for office, man. You can't tell that kind of truth and get elected.
Tavis Smiley, it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And the State of the Union is better with you around, but lots more work to do. That's your message always.
Appreciate it. Thank you, John.
Tavis Smiley is host of the Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International, the PBS television program by the same name, and has edited and compiled The Covenant with Black America 10 years later. Florida's attempt to insulate death penalty cases from the inflamed emotions of juries has apparently backfired. The Supreme Court invalidated a Florida death penalty law that gives judges a role in deciding some sentencing-related facts in the penalty phase in death penalty cases. The court said that violates the Sixth Amendment that guarantees the right to a trial by jury. Here to talk about this ruling is Marianne Franks, a professor of law at the University of Miami Law School. Welcome to The Takeaway, Professor.
Thank you.
Describe what the intent of this law was as you understand it.
Well, it's difficult to know exactly what the legislators intended. It could be that you want to keep the decision about the ultimate question of the death sentence, whether or not it will be imposed, away from the jury for various reasons. Maybe you think that juries are not particularly good at making that decision. Maybe you think the death penalty should be more easy to impose. So it could have been these types of motivations that would have led legislators to say, we really want the judge to have the ultimate determination here.
And boy, the Supreme Court was having none of it in the decision yesterday.
That's correct. The Supreme Court said that type of system that would allow a judge to make the determinations of certain types of fact with regard to making a defendant eligible for the death penalty, that's the kind of thing that would violate the Sixth Amendment.
Did the court view the judge as nullifying the jury's intent here if they give a recommendation of the death penalty and the judge were to refuse it for reasons of his own?
Well, no, because what the court did not say was that this question of the judge making the final determination, even if that's at odds with the jury, what's often referred to as judicial override, they did not in fact say that judicial override violates the Sixth Amendment. What they're suggesting is that what they did say in this case was that Florida's peculiar system, which would allow the judge to make findings of fact, that's the problem. It's not that the judge can't impose a penalty that's different from what the jury recommended, but the judge cannot make the findings of fact that are necessary.
So if, according to the Florida system, the judge is actually hearing facts that would relate to when you can apply the death penalty, like aggravating factors, premeditation, that sort of thing, it's that judge acting like a jury in evaluating those facts that the court finds most offensive. Would you say that's correct?
That's correct. What the court is saying is that it cannot be that the judge independently is making those determinations about those factors. That's the kind of thing that needs to be determined by the jury.
Has the court ever weighed into this territory here in sentencing phases? It hasn't been that long since the criminal system was bifurcated the way that it seems to be nationwide now.
That's right. So we had major upheaval in the 1970s with regard to the way that the death penalty was carried out. States had to revisit their procedures for how they were imposing the death penalty. And then the question became in the early 2000s, just what else the states actually had to do to comport with the constitutional rights. And you had this case in 2002, Ring versus Arizona, that said essentially what was affirmed in Hearst, which is when it comes to those determinations of aggravating factors that would make a defendant eligible for the death penalty, that kind of determination of fact needs to be made by the jury.
And there are hundreds of people that this affects on Florida's death row, right?
Potentially everybody on death row, potentially. That's 390 people at the moment. What is not clear at the moment is whether this decision is going to apply only to those people whose cases are still on direct appeal, or whether it would also apply retroactively to everybody who's on death row right now.
So what we know at this moment is that anybody that's appealed on this issue or others will get a second look, but the question remains whether retroactively anybody who's on death row, whether they've appealed or not, would get a second look.
Right, that anybody's case who still is active would have the opportunity to take advantage of this ruling and argue that it would apply to them and that it was not harmless error, as it's called. What's less clear and what would have to be worked out by the courts in Florida is whether or not it applies retroactively to those cases that have been given their final disposition.
And nobody hits the streets as a result of this. It would be a matter of death penalty versus what the other alternative would have been. That's the default.
Well, what these cases would have to look at would be to see whether or not, given the fact that the system Florida has in place currently is, in fact, unconstitutional, whether that system meant something for that defendant, that is to say that the outcome could have been different. If you can show that despite the state being wrong in its penalty imposition, that is to say its processes of penalty imposition, but nonetheless the same result would have happened, the jury still would have found these types of factors, still would have imposed the death penalty, then their so-called harmless error and nobody's punishment changes.
And it's not likely, or it's not the case, that you would throw out any of these cases entirely.
Well, if what we mean by throwing them out entirely, what we could say is that because of the way that the system works in Florida, in some cases, we might be able to show that were it not for the way Florida was doing this system, some defendants would not, in fact, have been sentenced to the death penalty. And if that's the case, the death penalty would then be off the table. And so we would probably revert to life in prison.
But guilt or innocence is not really a question in this case at all.
Exactly, because the guilt or innocence part of the trial, because we have these bifurcated trials, that would not be touched. That's not something that this particular ruling has anything to do with. It's only the imposition of the death penalty itself as a sentence.
Part of the challenge here related to the non-unanimity question in Florida. Why do you think the court didn't take a look at that?
Well, many people had hoped that the court would say something about the requirement for unanimous verdicts, which Florida is one of the few states that does not require unanimous verdicts for the imposition of the death penalty. Why it is that the court didn't want to talk about that in the context of the Sixth Amendment, it could be a number of reasons. It could be that we simply don't believe that the Sixth Amendment as such requires unanimous verdicts for this type of sentence. Could be that that's more properly thought of as an Eighth Amendment question. It could be just that the court thought this is a better way, that is to say the way they actually ruled is a better, narrower way of talking about the problem.
Marianne Franks is a professor of law at the University of Miami Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The price of oil is falling fast. Crude is at a 12-year low. Some varieties are already selling at just $30 a barrel. Good for the car business, not so much for oil producers like Nigeria, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia. Even formerly booming North Dakota is hurting. David Goldwin is a former State Department Special Envoy for International Energy Affairs. He's now the president of Goldwin Global Strategies. $30 a barrel, do you think that's a bottom, David?
Good to be with you, John. Actually, I don't think it's the bottom. It seems that this battle for market share led by Saudi Arabia is pushing production up and prices down. So the bottom could be in the 20s rather than $30.
Is this all Saudi Arabia? I mean, if they suddenly said, all right, we're done, what do you think the elasticity would be at that point?
Well, it depends on what you mean by we're done. They've been pushing up production as prices have been sinking. But if there were to be a production cut, then you could see prices rebound quite significantly. The overhang is probably around 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day. That's not that much in an 80 million barrel a day market. So if they were to engineer a production cut as they did in 1986, as they did in 1999, and cut back 2 million barrels a day, we'd see prices in the 60s. I think probably by the end of the year. But the politics don't seem to point in that direction at this moment.
But still, Iran is not online. Libya is not online. And there's a lot of Iraqi capacity left to come online, right?
That's right. If peace breaks out in Libya, which I think is devoutly to be wished, but unlikely to last very long, then you could see them rebound from close to zero back to maybe 800,000 barrels a day. Iraq, I think, is capped by infrastructure and the fact that they are having to devote most of their budget now to fighting ISIL. And I think we're unlikely to see We'll see Iran come back maybe in the 300 to 400,000 barrel a day range, not the kind of numbers they've been talking about. But you're right, we could have some supply surprises to the upside. Demand does not seem to be picking up, so that's why I think the bottom could be in the 20s rather than 30s.
And so that red line above which it's profitable and below which it's just kind of madness to even think about investing in oil, that would incorporate the North Sea, the Arctic, places like Venezuela, which is sort of running out of oil, and the tar sands, correct?
That's correct. And I think you can add to that all of the deep water in sub-Saharan Africa and offshore Brazil and a good part of the Gulf of Mexico as well. And the only people who can really produce oil profitably at $30 a barrel are the countries in the Arab OPECs. That's really Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE. The Northern Gulf, even Iran, Iraq, they're close to that, but they're higher than that. Everybody else is really going to need somewhere in the 50s to 60s to have sustainable production, and many of those areas you mentioned even higher than that.
Anything the president said about the success of sustainable energy like solar and wind, did that have anything to do with this or no?
Not really that much. Most of what the president talked about, the clean energy revolution, has to do with electricity, and very few countries still use oil for electricity, although some in the Caribbean and Central America do, and they'll probably be moving to natural gas. So we'll need a revolution in transportation in order to really impact the oil market. And that's really the irony and the thing to be feared here is that the long-term demand for oil from the developing world is really quite strong. So we're in a cycle right now. But if investment falls off and the economies recover, demand's going to pick up and we're going to be short of supply. And you'll have two places to look for, you know, for big increments. One is going to be the Arab OPEC countries again, but the other is probably going to be the United States, where we can be not a swing producer, but a surge producer. But there'll be a lot of pain in between.
Pain, though? I mean, doesn't this amount to a surplus in the sense that we're keeping that oil as an insurance policy in the ground by not pumping it now before we go?
Well, it works for the United States, but I have to say the thing to worry about is there, if you don't have big cash reserves and if you're not adapting to this market and if you don't have a diversified economy, you're in trouble. And that's Nigeria and Venezuela and probably Iraq. And so, you know, countries like Mexico are trying to use low fuel prices for cheaper electricity and more investment. But I think in the developing world, you're going to see a lot of pain. But for the U.S., we'll be back.
And there's not enough Advil to deal with Russia's pain right now, I would say. Probably, David?
Not the pain they're giving or the pain they're suffering.
David Goldman is former State Department Special Envoy for International Energy Affairs. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If I had $1 billion.
If I had
$1 billion.
And if I had
$1 billion.
If I $1 billion.
And if I had $1 billion.
If I had $1 billion.
Well, I'd buy you some art, a Picasso or a Garfunkel.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Okay, if I won the record $1.5 billion Powerball jackpot, I'd have $525 million after taxes. That means I could easily buy the Playboy Mansion for $200 million. Or a 30,000-square-foot Manhattan mansion, which goes for just $120 million, fully loaded. A private luxury 757 jet will cost around $100 million. But something more sporty? How about the F-22 Raptor fighter? That costs $150 million, but you got to bribe somebody at the Pentagon to get one. You like boats? How about $250 million for Russian fertilizer oligarch Andrei Igorovich Melnichenko? His sailing yacht is the largest in the world, 7 decks, a crew of 54, pool, helipad, movie theater gymnasium, and a keel made of curved glass for watching stuff underwater. Jeffrey Mashnikowski has no yacht, but he is an associate professor of biostatistics at the University of Buffalo. And he would say, just give it up, folks. He's done the math on your dismal odds of winning. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And did you really have to rain on everybody's Powerball parade there? You really have to?
Well, I do think that there is a positive side to it. And the positive side is that you're much, much, much more likely to win Powerball than complete a perfect NCAA college basketball bracket. So the odds aren't good, but there are a lot of other things in this world that we routinely do that are much more difficult than winning Powerball.
All right. Well, with that positive thought there, let's proceed with your mathematical analysis that, in fact, Powerball is so sort of set up that, in fact, it's a really bad investment. Your $2 doesn't have much of a return under almost any circumstances.
Yes, that's correct.
How does that work?
The payoff is obviously huge. It's in the billions, but after taxes, you're going to be back under $1 billion. But the odds being 1 in 292 million, if you multiplied those odds times your payoff, that's going to be a small number relative to the $2 that you invested. So the money that you can win and the probability of winning that money, you're still going to be in the red, as they say. So it's a losing proposition. And that $2 could be spent on doing things like boosting 401ks, increasing mortgage payments. Any of those kind of things are a better use of your $2.
Now, a lot of people use numbers that are of emotional significance to them, and that actually reduces your odds even more because you're not considering a lot of numbers that are there. Explain how that works.
What I think it does in the long term is potentially reduce your payouts. So if you think along birthdays and so on, you may have people choosing numbers between 1 in 12 and 1 in 31. And with more people taking those numbers, if those numbers were to come up, you're now splitting your jackpot with those folks.
So as a mathematician, you're a statistician at the University of Buffalo, right?
Yes.
And that's got to be a really, really exciting job, right?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, of course you do. Of course you do. And you've probably never thought for like even 1 second what you would do with $1.5 billion.
Yes, I really haven't given that a lot of thought.
Well, then could you make some history here and maybe give it a little bit of thought in the few seconds that we have?
My first step may be to hire a team of lawyers to figure out how I'm going to accept this money in terms of lump sum or over time and so on. And
you're going to, the first thing you're going to do is pay some lawyers. Anything more exciting than that?
I would look into retirement options and where I plan on spending my winters outside of Buffalo, I think would be the first investment property.
Well, Jeffrey, thanks so much. And
no problem.
If I win, I'll give you a call.
Sure.
I'll need your advice on lawyers if I do win. Jeffrey, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Jeffrey Michnikowski is a University of Buffalo statistician. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, providing resources to protect intellectual property, including trademark registration, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations for advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.